Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowain. Women and girls in Afghanistan have made some real gains since the fall of the Taliban more than a decade ago. More girls are attending schools which had been banned, and more women are serving in the government and in other positions of power. But the country is still desperately poor with a high rate of illiteracy. There are threats and attacks by insurgents and concerns about government effectiveness and the development of a civil society. Our guest, Hasina Sherjan, grew up in Afghanistan and fled with her family to the U.S. right before the Soviet invasion in the late 1970s. She helped set up clandestine classes for girls 20 years later when the repressive Taliban was back in power. Later, she found and became the CEO of Aid Afghanistan for Education, working to establish schools for marginalized Afghans. She's speaking tonight at the World Affairs Council here in Philadelphia. She joins us on Radio Times, wrote a book a couple of years ago, co-authored it with Michael O'Hanlon called Toughing It Out in Afghanistan. And Hasina, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
Nice to have you with us. You have a unique story to tell in that you lived in Afghanistan before the Soviet invasion. We've done a lot of programs about Afghanistan, but rarely with someone with your kind of perspective and experience. So I'm interested in starting about what Afghanistan was like before the Soviets invaded. Where were you, what, your family, were you living in Kabul at the time?
I grew up in Kabul, yes. I mean, to talk about what Afghanistan was like before the Soviets,
we could go on forever, right? We could be
having a few hours of conversation, or that's what the book I'm writing or working on will be. But, of course, Kabul was a very different place than what it is right now. You know, Kabul City was built for only 400,000 people, mm-hmm. and now we have perhaps 4 million people living in Kabul right now. And also, it was very green and beautiful and very few cars. And now it's full of concrete blockades and security, and you can barely move around.
But as a girl growing up in your country, you could go to school, you could go outside, you could live like a regular person.
Yes, of course. And women were very much free to do whatever they wanted to do. My mother opened the very first florist in Afghanistan. She brought in the first popcorn machine to Afghanistan. And most women that I knew in my family were all working. You know, her aunt became the first senator in Afghanistan. So it wasn't that we didn't have women in parliament or women in positions of power during the 70s and 60s.
Your family, I guess, fled the country before the Soviet invasion. Were you concerned that your family would be targeted, or are you just concerned that there was going to be violence and chaos in the country?
Yes, unfortunately, the pro-Soviet government that came to power in end of 1978 had already taken my father's cousin and his son-in-law, and so my father left, and then we also left about 2 months before the Russian invasion.
Wow, and came to the United States.
And came to the United
Seattle,
States.
Right?
To Seattle, yes.
And that's where you got an education here, or finished your education?
Some in Seattle, and then I moved to California, and I lived in north of San Francisco for many years, and then lived about 3 years in Washington, D.C.
I read that you went back. I guess it was a refugee camp, but it was in Pakistan, but a refugee camp for Afghans.
The first time, yes.
In the 90s, right?
In about 1995, I decided to go back to see what happened to all the Afghans that we left behind for the first time after 19 years of living in the U.S. So I went to visit Peshawar because I couldn't go into Afghanistan because of the factional war was still going on. And that's when everything changed in my life. In fact, that refugee camp visit really changed my life.
How so?
Well, for the first time, I realized that we were very privileged in Afghanistan to have everything available for us, and also realized my own ignorance of not really acknowledging the fact that not every Afghan had access to education in Afghanistan in the 70s. So realizing that women who were 50 years old were just learning how to read and write for the first time was quite shocking for me. And just witnessing the situation of how the Afghans were living in those refugee camps also made me realize that I could have been any of those women sitting there, because I was an Afghan and they were an Afghan. And it was purely luck that I was born in a family who could provide for me and bring me to U.S.
And was it mostly women in this refugee camp? Women and men?
Children? Women and men, yeah.
And the I mean, I'm assuming people have been living in this camp for some time at that point.
Of course, for many, many years, right, since the Russian invasion, and they had been living there.
And because of your conversations with people in the camp or women in the camp, you saw education as an important sort of point of liberation?
I think it was the first time that I realized that education or lack of education is what has been the reason why Afghans are where they are right now. Because in reality, back in the 70s, even, you know, there were only, based on UNESCO data, there was always, literacy rate was about 11% in Afghanistan.
Literacy.
So even today, we have at least 80% illiteracy in Afghanistan. Even though we may have 9 million students coming to school, but education is not taking place. And that's important.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to fight insurgency, how can we have a democracy with a population with no literacy or education? So I really, when I came back, we met with many other professional Afghans, and we realized that, yes, the education would be the very first thing. And I'm not saying that by educating the population, we're going to eliminate violence. However, that will be the foundation for peace.
And I do want to pick up on that, but I also read that you helped to start some of these underground schools or classes for girls. This is when the Taliban was in power. And I'm just wondering how these schools were able to operate, knowing, of course, the risks associated with educating girls, but also just the logistics of getting girls in and out of a building, for instance.
Well, I did go back into Afghanistan in 1999 during the Taliban period, because it was really difficult for me to accept the fact that suddenly, you know, girls were not allowed to go to school or women were not allowed to work. But after many meetings with the leaders of the Taliban, I realized that I was wasting my time, and I only had 2 weeks and $3,000 with me. So after meeting many of the teachers who were out on the streets begging to support their family, we set up 5 clandestine classrooms within these teachers' homes for 250 girls. So I continued to send money to somebody in Pakistan who would deliver that to the teachers monthly to pay their salaries and supplies and whatever else the students needed. But of course, the Taliban found out and they came in and they beat up the students and they beat up the teachers. And so it was very sad when I came back. Little girls were showing me their hands and saying that the Taliban came and beat me up. And but they continued coming, and that's what's more important. Because they continued coming to school, and they said that this is where we learn, and this is what, and they did extremely well. When I moved back in 2001, our third graders moved to fifth grade, and our fifth graders moved to seventh grade into formal education system.
Wow. So these were good teachers, and dedicated
and
students,
dedicated,
right?
And they had nothing else but to study.
But at great risk, yes.
At great risk, you know, but they had no other options. Mm.
And was it a matter of, you know, literally like sneaking books in and out of people's houses and pretending you were going there for one reason when you were actually going there for an education?
Well, I was there really to convince. I naively thought that I could convince the Taliban to open up the girls' schools. But then the girls, after the schools were discovered by the Taliban, they became very clever, and they would come there secretly, and they would hide their books and with the cover of the Quran, right, and pretending like they're going to a religious school.
Sneaking. Yeah. What was your argument to the Taliban? as you were meeting with them and trying to convince them that it was important to educate girls?
Well, at one point they said that they don't have money to continue girls' education. So I thought if that is really true and if that's the case, then money shouldn't be a problem. If they open up the schools, the whole world will pay for it. But obviously that was not the case. No.
What I found, and this goes back, gosh, you know, 12 years ago, when the Taliban fell, it seemed like within hours, people were bringing outside of, you know, from their basements, television sets and books and stereos, that there was this whole sort of underground of popular culture in that country. Did you see it that way?
I didn't really hear about all of that, but it's very possible. You can't really control people, yeah. I mean, they were still playing music and
that's what I was trying to get to.
And
yes.
Of course, they had their events and they were still doing everything secretly, taking the risk, of course. But every time, you know, they were found it, you know, they would be punished for it. But, you know, life goes on and you can't, you know, people have to be happy.
Tell us about Aid Afghanistan for Education.
Aid Afghanistan for Education has been working within Afghanistan since 2003, and we provide education for the marginalized Afghans. And that means people who didn't have access to education during the years of war or don't have access to formal education now. Because if you're 10 years old and never had access to education, and there are millions of Afghans, there is nothing for you within the formal education system.
You can't go to school.
So you're just dropped. Yeah, you're dropped from the system. And for boys, you know, what will they do? Either selling potatoes on the streets or joining the insurgents because they have to support their families. And we see millions of these 15-year-olds who are now joining the insurgents because there's nothing else for them. Girls who get married when they're very young, and this also happens every day, you know, they're 15 and they get married and they haven't finished their high school. Legally, the formal education system doesn't have any place for them. So Aid Afghanistan for Education is really the only program that will take them through 12th grade and they graduate with us. And also, Aid Afghanistan for Education is the only NGO with an agreement with the Ministry of Education so that the ministry will provide our graduates their high school diploma. So high school diploma is a very, very important document for the students. It opens up doors for them. They can work. They can continue their higher education if they like. And also, it has changed dynamics of family lives, in fact. The fact that, you know, children have more respect for their mothers now, even, you know, it reduced domestic violence. The husbands have more respect for the wives because the wives are studying with the kids. Majority of the husbands are illiterate. So that's what we're doing.
Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Hasina Sherjan, and she is the founder and CEO of Aid Afghanistan for Education, as she said, working to establish schools for marginalized Afghans, and was born in Afghanistan, spent some time in the U.S. She lives in Kabul now, wrote a book, co-authored it with Michael O'Hanlon just a couple of years ago called Toughing It Out in Afghanistan. Any questions or comments, give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Live Nation supports WHYY and welcomes alternative rockers Arcade Fire to Philadelphia March 17th at Wells Fargo Center. American Express presale now through Thursday. Tickets for general public available Friday. Tickets at ComcastTix.com or Wells Fargo Center box office.
This week in This American Life, in seventh grade, Domingo and his mom and dad were all on the highway near the U.S.-Mexican border in separate cars, doing something they had never done before, and it was not going well.
Oh God, my mother says. I had never heard her voice so charged with fear. She grabs the knob that controls the headlights and flashes at Dad.
Smuggling marijuana with your parents this week.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, the women who worked in the Kennedy White House, their jobs important yet little recognized.
Jobs couldn't have been done without us. I think many of our so-called bosses understood that. I don't know that any of them particularly admitted it out loud.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Trader Joe's, offering cranberry sauce and cranberry orange relish made with natural cranberries, water, and sugar. Store locations at TraderJoe's.com. Trader Joe's proudly supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. Our guest, Hasina Sherjan, says that Afghanistan's future depends in large part on how it educates its people. She grew up in Afghanistan, came to the United States right before the Soviets invaded her country. She now lives in Kabul and founded and is the CEO of Aid Afghanistan for Education. Again, speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the World Affairs Council here in Philadelphia, and obviously joining us today on Radio Times. We've been doing a lot of programs about Afghanistan over the last dozen years. Any questions or comments, give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. So how many schools does your organization have at this point?
There are 13 schools in 9 provinces. We have 3,000 female students, and we have 104 boys as well. Now, the program was not designed to only have female students, but unfortunately in 2003, none of the donors were willing to support education for boys, and I think they are witnessing the consequences now because we really need to focus on both genders and equally educate men and women in Afghanistan. So we are now starting, and I'm hoping that we will expand and provide education for men.
Well, and I would assume not just under the Taliban, but the fact that Afghanistan has been in some form of conflict or war for, 20 years now, that it's got to make it really difficult to try to establish an education system under those circumstances, those conditions.
Well, I mean, longer than 20 years, yeah. Yes, it was under circumstances, you mean now or then?
Well, now and then.
But yeah, of course, during the years of war.
Sure.
I mean, it wasn't only girls that were not allowed to go to school. The boys were also not learning anything. And many people didn't send their boys to school because of that. And now it's also, of course, very difficult because suddenly millions and millions of people and the whole population, and we really need to educate the population and not really focus only on the kids.
Right.
There's so much work, and there's a need for the reform of the education system in Afghanistan, not only with the primary and secondary, but we need to also reform the university education also. So we have a lot of work to do still.
Are there enough teachers, enough qualified teachers?
There are, of course, not enough qualified teachers, but, teachers are not something that you can just produce overnight. And that takes time. However, we have to be very creative and innovative at times like this, because there are students that are coming out of, thousands of students are coming out of Kabul University every year, and there are no jobs for them. So if we can take them and give them a crash course and send them out to provinces to rotate and teach people so that we can educate the population as fast as we can.
As you said, the literacy rate was about 10% when you were growing up. Now it's about 20%. So obviously some progress in recent years. But nonetheless, that means that most of the country, can't read or write?
Exactly. Most of the country can't read and write, and we're having an election.
Right.
For, how will they be able to logically, decide for themselves who they should vote for? They can't read or write, and so they have to rely on somebody else telling them who they should vote for.
Has the country, I know that about 40% of children are going to school now. I know sometimes it's hard to figure out if numbers are correct or not.
I have no idea where these numbers are generated
well,
from.
I wanted to ask you that.
Because, census has not happened in Afghanistan. They started working on it back in 2005 and 2006, and it was not completed. Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult to even know how many children there are. They're making a lot of assumptions.
Right.
So we can't really rely on numbers out of Afghanistan.
Does the government support education? Is there any way to know that? I guess in terms of investing money or talking about it?
The schools are open for all Afghans. Education has been compulsory in Afghanistan always, but people didn't have access to education always. So children are coming to school, but I think that for government to really support education, I like to see a reform of the system. Mm-hmm. I like to see that we have innovative programs and working with NGOs very closely, outsourcing classrooms, making sure that quality education is what the population will receive. That has not happened. You know, we're still in rote system where there's a lot of memorization, and classrooms are only, they're very large. You know, there's sometimes, 65 students. So by the time the teacher takes roll, and it's only 35 minutes. So the time is up, and I think I'm more concerned about the fact that no education is taking place. Because if you talk to universities, some of the good universities in Kabul right now, private universities, or American University of Afghanistan, the professors were telling me that students are crying in the classrooms because they don't know how to take notes, they don't know how to study, they don't know how to learn. I mean, just to learn how to learn is a whole challenge by itself. So they don't know how to do any of this, and they're sitting in a university classroom.
Happens in this country too, as well. I mean, I think that's a universal problem.
Yes.
You talked about the fact that even those who might be graduating from college, whether there are jobs for them or not, are you concerned about a quote unquote brain drain out of Afghanistan? People looking, keeping with education and skills.
Unfortunately, because there, people have had a lot of hopes. Yeah, in 2002 and 2003 and up to 2005, and as the security got tighter and tighter and violence increased, unfortunately, smarter, younger Afghans are looking to get out now. So we really need to do everything we can to keep them in Afghanistan, because they're really the future of Afghanistan, and they will have to be continuing to hold offices and work. So it's a huge challenge.
And that's Hasina Shirjan, and she is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about her life in Afghanistan. She was born there, came to the U.S. Just before the Soviets invaded that country. She now lives in Kabul and founded and became the CEO of Aid Afghanistan for Education, again working to establish schools for marginalized Afghans, whether boys or girls. And I do want to talk about men and women as well. And again, any questions or comments that you might have, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. The world has been riveted about the Pakistani girl Malala, who, as we know, the Taliban threw acid in her face when she was so outspoken about education. She has been so eloquent about her determination to get an education for herself and for other girls. Do you see her as representing something for Afghan girls?
She was shot, by the way.
Oh, shot, yes.
She was shot. She's in Pakistan, and I think that it's great that, she, and I'm sure that there are thousands of young girls like her who are really ambitious and they want an education for themselves and may not have the courage that Malala has had, and we have the same in Afghanistan also. But we shouldn't really wait for something like that to happen in order to pay attention to what's important and what's necessary. The fact that I have just been going around now to meet with many of the, government officials here. I met with Leader Pelosi and with Congresswoman Lowy and others while I was in Washington, making sure that we will continue the investment that has already been made in Afghanistan and not really dropping it. Yeah, I mean, if we only look at Aid Afghanistan for Education programs, USAID funded these programs since 2007 for 5 years. This was millions of dollars. Yeah, I mean, our budget is over $1 million a year. That comes to $1 per student per day, in fact, And I've been traveling and speaking at some of these private schools in the States now. I was, in fact, at Linden Hall School. It's a beautiful private school. Of course, it's $50,000 a year, you know. And if you really calculate, a dollar a day per student is nothing that you can give them quality education. So it's really crucial that we pay attention before something like Malala or before something like September 11 happens. So we need to use preventives. We need to be aware of the fact that if education should really be the foundation for any society or people, you know, I think what education can give one an individual, nothing else can, you know. Money and things can always go away, but just like what happened in the Philippines or an earthquake can happen and can take away all your things. But education is the only thing that you can have, and you can always start over again and be successful again. So I think it's crucial to be aware of the priorities when we are rebuilding or assisting or wanting to help a society or a nation to rebuild itself.
You might not experience this because obviously you live in Kabul, and I think for a number of people in this country, there's a sense of pessimism about Afghanistan, a worry about its future, questioning, you know, what the U.S. has accomplished there, whether we should still stay there, what is our mission, what is our relationship between these two countries. And I'd just be curious about your perspective on U.S.-Afghan relations.
It gives me hope when I go to, you know, I was attending the World Affairs Council National Conference in Washington just last week. And when Mrs. Bush, Laura Bush, was speaking about the importance of supporting Afghan girls' education in Afghanistan, although I hope that she will also support the Afghan boys' education, but I think the having this conversation is very hopeful, and also at the U.S.-Afghan Women Council event at Georgetown University, where the Secretary of State was speaking, and Mrs. Clinton and Laura Bush again were all very supportive of the fact that we shouldn't really abandon Afghanistan again and pay attention to education. So I'm really hoping that we will pay attention to education, and education is just as important or more important than building roads. Economic development is, of course, important, but I think you cannot really develop an economy with a population that is not educated. So I'm really hoping that we will put a little bit more attention to education.
Are there still feelings in Afghanistan, though, that girls should not be educated, whether it comes from the government itself or what's left of the Taliban or the, you know, the insurgency people, in a sense, making it difficult for girls and women to get an education?
Well, the good news is that I when I was visiting one of our schools in Semangan province a few months ago, 80% of our students said that their husbands encourage them to go to school. And one of them said, who's a 27-year-old mother, was sitting at 11th grade, and when I asked her, why are you coming to school now? Yeah. And she said, you know, I have a son who's in first grade, and when he came home and asked me to do homework, and I couldn't do homework with him, he cried all night, and I told my husband the next day that whether you like it or not, I have found a school and I'm going to do this. So ever since I've been coming here, my relationship with my son, my family is a much happier family, and we are now all studying together. So I think I realized that it could be that the husbands are not literate. Mm-hmm. So for them, it's easier to say, go to your mother to do your homework with, rather than saying that I'm not literate. And that's good. So I think, and fathers are very supportive of their daughters, and some of them, whenever we have an event or a graduation, the fathers always come and speak, and we have a very good relationship. We have committees, parents' committees in every school, so we're very much in touch with the parents and families and communities to make sure that they are supportive of the schools.
Are there certain myths about Afghanistan that you think are harmful to that country, beliefs about the country that are not true?
You know, of course, there are a lot of myths about Afghanistan, as there are a lot of myths about America,
sure.
You know. And unfortunately, the myths are only based on one news. If there's one news that a husband cut the nose and the ears of his wife, then suddenly, you know, everybody thinks that every Afghan man cuts the nose and the ears of their wife. Well, not only this time, every time I travel to U.S., I listen to radio all the time.
Do you?
And if you really listen to what happens in America and what these husbands do to their wives, or men who go out shooting randomly in schools or churches and shopping centers, then there's also, you know, can be this myth that, you know, every American man abuses their wives and go around shooting because everybody has a gun in America, yeah? So we really have to be very careful about this kind of assumptions or generalization about countries. I mean, speaking at various universities and colleges this trip, it's been a very mind-opening for me and also for the students. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I ask them what they think of Afghanistan, they always say war and desert. And I showed them a bunch of pictures of Afghanistan, that there is really no desert. There's a lot of beautiful rivers and mountains and just extremely beautiful sceneries, and they're always surprised. And then now there's a whole movement starting. Where I was speaking at Millersville University, Kutztown University, I was speaking at Lehigh University here yesterday, and Lebanon Valley College.
All in Pennsylvania, yeah.
All of Pennsylvania, that students are extremely mature, I have to say, and they are now interested, and a whole movement is starting for to bring peace through education in Afghanistan. And, you know, we can't just leave everything for the governments. Mm. I think it's really time for us to take the matters in our own hands and do something. And I think if we can really organize something that where they can directly be in contact with our students in Afghanistan, and we can have video conferencing with them. So it's all just happening, and it's very exciting.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation and also get some callers in as well. And again, our guest is Hasina Sherjan, founder and CEO of Aid Afghanistan for Education. And again, she's speaking tonight at 7 at the World Affairs Council, obviously joining us here in our Philadelphia studios. And she co-authored a book with Michael O'Hanlon called Toughing It Out in Afghanistan. And we've been talking about her work to educate marginalized members of Afghan society, whether boys or girls. And again, we're going to take some more calls or take some calls after this very short break at 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
It's been 50 years since John F. Kennedy was killed in Dallas, and it's easy to forget that before he became a figure of myth and memory, he was a president.
We are confronted primarily with a moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures, and it's as clear as the American Constitution.
We'll talk about Kennedy's struggles with civil rights. That's next time on Tell Me More.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, Key and Peele, we talk with Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele about their sketch comedy show on Comedy Central. Many of their sketches deal with race and draw on their experiences being biracial. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
a diamond in the rough.
We're trying to do the right thing. It's very hard. We've got top people involved inside and outside the company, and hopefully over time we will make this a much smaller issue.
J.P. Morgan chief Jamie Dimon takes another hit after a $13 billion settlement. Assessing his future, that's next time on The Takeaway.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Again, talking with Hasina Sherjan, founder and CEO of Aid Afghanistan for Education. We're talking about her work in Afghanistan, where she was born and where she lives now. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Fareed from Bryn Mawr to join us. Fareed, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I would like to give my best regards to my sister, Hasina.
Absolutely.
And I'm from Afghanistan, as I mentioned, and I'm listening to her, and it's
good.
It's a pleasure listening to our sisters and brothers to go back to Afghanistan and help the Afghan people who have suffered for the last three decades, basically, since before the invasion of Soviet Union.
Sure.
I left Afghanistan towards the end of that occupation. And I went there a few times, and like Hasina mentioned, the education is so important. A lot of problems that I noticed, or at least I think, has caused all the problems we have in Afghanistan is lack of education. And it has been like that since, you know, I would say the last five, sixth century.
Mm-hmm.
Education was like minimal, and even if there was, like, the subjects were like basically too old for, you know, the time that they were teaching. Teachers weren't getting paid well, and so there was a lot of problems of that nature. And one of two other things that I would
well,
like
you know
to
what, Fareed? Yeah, hold on just one second. Let me give Hasina a chance to weigh in on that. And obviously, he's underscoring what you said, which is that education is so critical. But this is not a brand new problem for Afghanistan. Would you agree with that?
I do agree. Salam, Fareedjan. Nice to hear from you. It's nice to hear that our Afghans are listening. And I hope others will also call. I definitely, it's not a new phenomena at all, but in even during the peaceful times of Afghanistan, you know, when the king was there and we had, you know, 40 years of peace, unfortunately, there was not as much progress. There was peace, but, you know, I mean, peace is nice, but of course, if you don't progress and work on progress and work on educating the population, and this is where you end up being. But now we should do something about it. I think we can't afford to ignore it any further. And we really need support of people like Fareed and other Afghans, because Afghanistan can only be rebuilt by Afghans. Mm. You know, we can't rely on international community to rebuild our country. You know, it's like relying on somebody else to coming into your house and rearrange your furniture for you. We need to do it on our own. And if the fact that we are, I mean, the reason that I'm staying in the U.S. as long as I am staying now this on this trip is because USAID funding ended in March. We have not paid the salaries of 256 teachers for the past 6 months. And they're still teaching, which is amazing. You know, they can't imagine sending 3,000 students home. You know, the very little hope that has been developed in this last 12 years will totally be diminished if we send 3,000 students home. So, but I also feel that, okay, well, USAID supported for 5 years. It was not going to be a permanent solution anyway. The permanent solution will be eventually that the government will have to take responsibility for the program. It's a huge program, and and they should have this program under the Ministry of Education. But we need reform of the whole policy of the ministry. The reason Aid Afghanistan for Education exists is because there is nothing for these students within the formal education system. So Until then, we need the support of our Afghan brothers and sisters who are in the U.S. and who cannot really afford a dollar per day per student. And they can easily, you know, adopt a student, sponsor a student, and all we need is 3,000 Afghans in the U.S. to support each student, and the problem is solved.
Fareed, let me give you a chance to just raise one more point, if you don't mind. Go ahead.
Yes, she's absolutely right there. And the reason I mentioned, like, the education from, like, way back, that's the core cause of the problems that we have in Afghanistan. For the Taliban come in and other groups that came in. If you look into, like, these groups, for the most part, 99% of these people has no education. And somebody gives a little fatwa in the name of Islam, which is another, you know, hurt that the Muslim population is taken today from, you know, all other entities, is because of that. And the two
you know
other,
what, Fareed, yeah, Fareed, yeah. I want to thank you for calling into Radio Time, and I appreciate your call and obviously your concern. And as Hasina was saying, there are certainly numbers of Afghans living in this country with a great deal of concern about what's going on in the country where they were born. Hasina,
and that's what gives me hope, even though a lot of them may not want to come back to Afghanistan, but they don't have to come back to Afghanistan for whatever reason it is, although I would like to see them coming back to Afghanistan, because Afghanistan can only be rebuilt by Afghans who have come to U.S. or to other, you know, European countries or anywhere else, or India or in the region, who are well-educated, who have worked with the various companies and governments, and they know how to build institutions, because that's what we need. People who are in power right now, they don't. The majority of them are not even educated. So we need people to come back and rebuild the country. I mean, America is a great place, but it belongs to somebody else. It's not ours.
So what do you think about the U.S. Removing most of its troop, most of its presence in Afghanistan, military presence in Afghanistan? It's still under negotiations,
you know,
at this point.
I mean, my book with Mike tells you how we we should continue to keep the military forces in Afghanistan, and why that is so important, and how we can win this war. I believe that although as much as I believe that, you know, we cannot win any wars by just fighting and killing anymore, because you kill and they kill, and how, you know, continue killing one another. And really the solution is to provide education and give them job opportunities so people work, and slowly insurgency will die off. It always does, you know. However, right now, I don't personally see Americans going anywhere from Afghanistan. If you're in Kabul and you see the amount of investments made in Afghanistan, right now, as I was leaving, I was at the embassy the week before I was leaving, and there's a huge complex being built right now within the embassy. So for various reasons, they're going to stay in Afghanistan, yeah? So we'll see within the next 2-3 days anyway, as the Jirga will be determining whether we're signing this agreement. I have a feeling that we're going to have to sign this agreement. There might be some compromises on both sides, but it has to be signed.
Well, let me ask you about, because according to the news reports today, that this agreement is requiring or asking that President Obama essentially, I guess, admit to military mistakes when U.S. forces have gone into people's houses and people have been wounded or even killed, that they want an admission, I guess, from the President of the United States. Does that seem like a reasonable request?
They want an admission. Who?
I'm just quoting here from the New York Times. Months of fraught negotiations and public posturing over how a long-term American military force would remain in Afghanistan have suddenly come down to a demand for a single personal gesture, a display of contrition by President Obama for military mistakes that have hurt Afghans.
Is that what's requested from the Afghan government?
Yes.
Will the president do that?
I don't know. I'm just wondering whether
I think it's always nice to admit our mistakes and to apologize for it. Mm-hmm. And of course, that we need that in various different levels. Not only that America has to do that for Afghan people. Afghan people owe that to themselves because of all the atrocities that took place during the factional wars. Nobody came out to apologize to the people. So people of Afghanistan definitely deserve apologies from not only America, but from their own leaders who are in power right now. They really also owe the people of Afghanistan an apology.
What do you think of Hamid Karzai?
I don't know. I've met President Karzai various times. You know, he actually came to our house before he was the president. I think as a leader in Afghanistan, we really need to look at what's best for Afghanistan. And I don't think he has done that. Mm. You know, what's best for our people? What is best for the future of Afghanistan, and to place people in the positions of power who can really rebuild the country, and not really focusing on tribal issues and problems. The tribal issues and problems is really not an Afghan problem. If you really go into villages and ask people, they would never say, you know, I'm from this tribe and I'm from that tribe, or I have a problem with this tribe or that tribe. You know, my parents come from two different tribes in Pashtun and Tajik, and I didn't even know that until much later in my life. So I think to focus on putting Mujahideen leaders in positions of powers to please them or to appease them for fighting the wars against the Soviet. It's a great thing that they fought against the Soviet, of course, but I think we should be very strategic about who we put in positions of ministerial positions or other important, you know, leadership positions in Afghanistan to make sure that we are building the country, and not because that they fought the Soviet. Mm. So this was not done, and that was disappointing for me.
So you're suggesting it's not good or not right to talk to the Taliban, because there has been certainly talk in this country about negotiating with the Taliban, moving Afghanistan forward.
I don't know where
is anything gained by that.
I'm not really sure. It's funny because I published an op-ed in New York Times in 2009 regarding this reconciliation, and I can publish that again and again and again because nothing's changed.
Oh, interesting.
So since 2009, this conversation started, and I'm not really sure whose brilliant idea that was, that we're going to reconcile with the Taliban, and it's not very clear to me why we're reconciling, and what is it that we're going to gain by this reconciliation, and what is it that they're going to gain by this reconciliation. And if we haven't had any results since 2009, why are we wasting time and energy? And I think if we spend all that time and energy on educating the population and how to really develop the economy of Afghanistan, we may have been in a better place by now. I don't see, you know, that we're going to get any result from focusing any more on reconciliation with the Taliban.
You said earlier that the war can be won in Afghanistan. What do you mean by that? As you talk about, what does the war look like? You live in Kabul. What does winning mean? What does that look like?
I live in Kabul. We don't fortunately see the war every day.
You don't.
I mean, the war is mostly in the south. Of course, there are suicide bombing in the city periodically, which is very unfortunate. And again, there are a lot of casualties and people that had nothing to do with it. So I think if we really focused on winning the war militarily. Mm-hmm. We should have done it by now. If, you know, we have 165,000 well-trained international troops with any kind of equipment that you can imagine. And we're fighting a group of people who, it's a guerrilla war. We don't really know how many of them are there. And occasionally they say it's 25,000 or whatever, you know, in 20, we can't fight a 25,000 guerrilla that are fighting with. So what, something is wrong. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that our attention has really been diverted to various different places like reconciliation, than really focusing that, no, you know, what is good for us is to develop Afghanistan, to do everything we can to educate the population and to have a government that is for Afghanistan and in a well-educated government, in a government that can really be concerned about the people of Afghanistan and to reduce corruption. I mean, it's really embarrassing to know that Afghanistan has one of the most corrupt governments in the world. So I think winning for me means that we really need to focus on what we're doing and to continue doing what we started doing at the beginning in 2002.
Well, on that note, my thanks to you for joining us today on Radio Times, and good luck with your work in Afghanistan. Hasina Shajan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And she's the founder, CEO of Aid Afghanistan for Education. And again, she's speaking tonight at the World Affairs Council in Philadelphia at 7 o'clock. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. You can also send me Twitter. Go to at Marty Moss Cohen. Al Banks and Adam Staniszewski are engineers for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.